As you just heard, you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I am Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, April 18th, 2011. And today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with nonfiction author Susan Kushner Resnick. A journalist for 25 years, Susan Kushner Resnick's work has appeared in The Best American Essays, New York Times Magazine, Boston Magazine, Salon.com, and Utney Reader. She's the author of Sleepless Days, One Woman's Journey Through Postpartum Depression. Her latest book, Goodbye, Wives and Daughters, concerns a 1943 coal mine disaster that left the town of Bear Creek, Montana, devastated. When I spoke to Susan, I asked her to talk about how she learned of the disaster and how she came to write about it.
Well, I was on a family vacation, and we had nothing else to do except go to this club, or it wasn't even a club, it was a saloon for that had pig racing in it.
Okay.
And on the walls of the restaurant were all the articles from when the mine disaster happened. And I started reading them and saying, I need to read the book about this. And then I found out later while interviewing people in the saloon that there was no book about it.
Right. Now, why do you suppose there was no book ever written and nobody had ever...
Well, I think some people had made a few attempts but never really followed through. But I think part of it is that it happened during World War II, and people just kind of brushed it aside because there was so much suffering happening. They also didn't tell their families too much about the suffering. I've found people who have said, thank you for telling my family story, because they wouldn't tell me how bad it was. So I think it was just pushed under the rug. Also, it was kind of a company town. Nobody wanted to admit that the guys were probably killed unnecessarily because they were still working there.
Right, right. And has the feedback from the town been mostly positive, do you know?
Oh, yes. I went there to launch the book, and it was great because that was my biggest fear, that I would get it wrong and that they would be angry that I, this outsider, took their story. But they have seemed very happy with it, mm-hmm. which is the best.
Yeah, and it seems from the book, which we'll talk more about in a minute, but it seems like you got a lot of cooperation from the town. A lot of people gave you interviews, I'm assuming. Is that right?
Yeah, I ended up interviewing about 80 people,
wow.
and only two people wouldn't talk to me. One was a woman whose father was the ordering guy of supplies.
Okay.
And I guess he probably should have ordered proper equipment. So she was politely just said she didn't want to talk. And the other one was Tony Boyle's daughter. Tony Boyle was kind of
right.
a bad guy who was a hero in my book. And she would pretended she wasn't who she was. Like she'd say on the phone, oh, she's on vacation. I know it's you. But and I tried to tell her, no, this is going to be the only good portrait of your father. But she wouldn't speak to me.
Oh, she probably had a lot of negative feedback from people before.
Oh, I'm sure.
Well, just in general terms, before we start talking about this particular event, coal mining is obviously known to be very dangerous work, and particularly if certain measures aren't taken to ensure worker safety. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what the various dangers are.
Well, the biggest danger is the buildup of natural gas in the mine, which is just a byproduct of coal. But if the mine is not ventilated properly, it can build up, and it's very combustible. But it's really easy to vent properly. They've known since the 20s how to avoid these disasters, but they just keep happening because that takes time and money, and usually the owners of the mines don't want to deal with all that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very simple process to get rid of this methane gas.
And in addition to the methane, another issue that was important in Bear Creek was the narrow tunnels. Is that right?
Yeah. Usually there are narrow tunnels, and that's why they have to make sure air is flowing in the right direction, and there are fans and things like that. And they put up cloths. They used to put up these canvas cloths just to keep the air from going into places it shouldn't.
Okay.
And that wasn't taken care of properly.
Oh, okay. Susan, I wonder, can you describe rock dusting and why it's important?
Rock dusting, it's actually, they throw something that's kind of like lime onto the coal dust. Coal dust just can spark up from almost nothing and cause a big explosion. But this heavier material keeps it down, so then it won't be floating all over the air. And that's something that they weren't doing in the mine. They were not rock dusting, even though everyone knew, common knowledge was that you have to dust in a mine.
Right, and they weren't entirely honest about what they were and weren't doing. Is that right, as far as their safety precautions?
Oh, they were complete liars,
right.
I would say. Yeah, because the owners knew that there were 200 safety violations brought to their attention 3 months before this, and they kind of said to the inspectors, yeah, we'll fix it. Because the inspectors had said, you know, we got to close you down unless you fix these things. And they said, sure, we'll fix them. And then they ended up going on their annual vacation to California instead. So some of the things were addressed, but not the most important expensive issues.
Okay. And so what exactly happened
on that day of February 27th?
Right. What sparked this particular tragedy?
Well, I've tried to piece it together, and so has the grandson of one of the guys who died, or great-grandson, using all the records that are available. And the thing that everyone thinks happened is that somebody had an open lamp on their head, which is, you know, the miners' hats with the lights.
Right.
Even back in 43, they had battery-operated ones, but people in this mine were still using the ones that were fuel injected kind of little fires on their head. So the theory is that someone with one of these little fires on their head walked into some kind of spark and started the explosion, which in turn made all that coal dust go up.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the guys died from the blast injuries, but most died just from the air that built up because they couldn't get out in time. They didn't have proper rescue equipment either on them or back at headquarters.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, before we talk more, I think maybe it's a good time for you to read from the book, if you would.
Okay. All right. I'm going to read from the first chapter, which is called The Romance. The bulk of the story is told through the viewpoint of the women and the families, children, boys and girls left behind, and what they were doing and what they experienced during it. So this introduces two of my main characters, Bud and Mary. So I'll just read a few pages of that.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay. She should have thrown salt over her shoulder, knocked wood, spit onto her fingertips, anything to fight back the evil spirits. Instead, Mary Wakenshaw practically invited them into her house. Dear Bud, she wrote to her husband, I'm glad I'm a coal miner's wife and thankful for it. She was comparing herself to the women she saw all around her on a California military base in 1943. Those wives, the unlucky ones, were hugging and kissing their men for what they knew could be the last time. The soldiers' wives had come from all over the country to say their goodbyes before the men crossed the ocean to fight for the best American values, democracy with all of its fair play and justice, and capitalism, which paved the way for anyone to realize his dreams of wealth and freedom. Those wives were making a noble sacrifice. Still, it wasn't easy to say goodbye. Really, Mary wrote, describing the sad scene, it's pathetic to see them grasp the few minutes of happiness they can. She was on a road trip with her daughter, Fanny, a tall girl with broad shoulders and a confident smile. Fanny had come to the base to marry her high school sweetheart before he shipped off. She adored the young man so much that she'd pasted the butt from the last Camel cigarette he'd smoked before leaving home 6 months earlier into her scrapbook. Now, finally, she'd get to be his wife. Mary, Fanny, and the boy's parents and brother had traveled 54 hours by train from their homes in the Montana mining town of Bear Creek. They drove 2 hours to the Billings, Montana train depot, boarded an overnight that took them past snow and mountains and more snow before stopping in damp Portland, Oregon, where they switched to another sleeper that would bring them to California. The trains were crowded and dusty with overpriced coffee and lousy cheese sandwiches for sale. Mary's hands were always dirty. Fanny slept with her head on her mother's shoulder, but Mary couldn't find herself a comfortable position. Instead of resting, she wrote letters to Bud, sometimes twice a day. "I pinned the balance of my money in a rag and in my girdle, so hope it's safe enough," she wrote. She told him about the soldiers who mobbed the train platforms and the pair escorting a prisoner of war. Though the country had been at war for more than a year, it had touched Mary in the form of ration books and tire drives, but this was her first close-up look at it. "Bud, you couldn't believe in a million years what war is like till you see it out here," she wrote in one of the letters. "I mean soldiers, huge barracks built in the hills, and soldiers, soldiers everywhere. It's a beautiful day out. I hope it stays nice." The train swayed and her pen jumped. She had to pause when she lost her daylight to the eclipse of a tunnel, but she never broke her connection with Bud. She was only 38, but they were coming up on their 20th wedding anniversary. They'd buried three children, raised one to adulthood, and seemed to be doing a decent job with their boy, Bobby, who was about to turn 12. He was a good kid, though sometimes prone to typical pre-adolescent shenanigans. In December, a boy at school had called him a Jap, probably the most vile insult to spit at a kid in those times, so Bobby slugged him. The teacher banned Bobby from the annual Christmas pageant, so he had to endure the humiliation of watching from the audience right next to his mother. But if that was their son's worst crime, Mary and Bud could consider themselves lucky. They were lucky in love, too. They'd reached that stage in their marriage during which so many couples, even those who held on to respect and affection, become more business partners than romantic ones. But Mary and Bud seemed to have preserved the tender parts of their relationship. She asked often in her letters if he missed her, and she signed every one of them with a plea for his safety: take care of yourself. Because she knew that her family was making a sacrifice too. Bud was a coal miner working more hours than ever because of the war. Coal fueled those trains that took the soldiers and their wives all over the country. It powered the factories where the girl riveters worked, assembling bombers and ships for the war. The very coal her husband cleared from under the Bear Creek Hills went directly to the Army and Navy. Mining as much coal as possible was considered a patriotic duty. Bud's mine ran 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. Unlike the soldiers' wives, who were new at this game, Mary sent her husband into danger every day. But when the possibility of death hovers for most of your life, as it had for Mary, first she worried for years about her coal mining father, who'd already had his head smashed by falling rock in the mine, and now Bud, it didn't feel as scary anymore. It became normal, almost unnoticeable. Maybe, in order to get up every morning and watch a man go into the earth, you need to numb yourself a bit.
Thank you very much. I'll just mention that's Susan Kushner Resnick reading from Goodbye Wives and Daughters, which is published by the University of Nebraska Press. So you describe the individual stories of a number of the victims and survivors and families, and I'm wondering how much creative license did you take to present their points of view and stories?
Well, I don't think any. I did a lot of research on what their lives were like just through talking to them, through reading personal letters they'd written to each other and to other people, newspaper accounts, so I could know exactly what was happening at that time and what the person looked like and what they would have been thinking through asking them or their family members. So it's all nonfiction. I'm very much a pure nonfiction writer.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like some of the scenes that you presented in the mine during the accident were based on the evidence that they found afterwards. Like, I remember there was this one part where a man was running away from the explosion, and they later found his handprints along the sides of a coal car. So it sounds like you kind of were able to piece together the movements of the men in the mine after the accident. Is that...
Yeah, well, that particular story came right from his daughter.
Okay.
But I have extensive records because there were all these inspections afterward. The state, the federal inspectors, the coal company, the union all did inspections, so I got all of those reports.
Mm.
And they overlap, and they say, you know, this person was here and walked this many feet and that kind of thing. So, yeah I could recreate the scene that way.
Now, how many actual survivors or witnesses are still living?
Well, there were only three survivors, so they are not living anymore.
Okay.
And the last wife had died right before, widow had died the year before I started. But there were a lot of their children around, and also community members, people who helped with the rescue. I'd say probably, 40 or 50 people.
Mm-hmm. And did you talk to many people who would have been contemporaries of the families? You know, people maybe that would now, I suppose, be in their 80s and 90s.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I talked to as many as possible. And even the children are in their late 70s.
Yeah.
But, I talked, there's one man who's still alive who's close to 90, and he was a rescuer, although he would not tell me that much because he just said it was too painful. He still couldn't speak about everything.
Mm.
But he kind of off the record confirmed all the things I was finding and all of my theories.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the title. The title of the book is Goodbye Wives, W-I-F-E-S, and Daughters. Where did you get the title from?
The title comes from a note that some of the men wrote while they were in the mine. About five guys survived for a while, and they wrote goodbye notes to their families on these pieces of wood that they ripped off of boxes that held explosives.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the notes started, Goodbye Wives and Daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And I had debates with people about whether I should clean that up and make it wives, because I didn't want anyone to think I was making fun of their ignorance with grammar. But most people agree that I should keep it wife.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of who this person was, and his life was about this other thing, you know. He wasn't a man of letters. He was a man of the mines, probably. So.
Right. Yeah, and a couple of them signed that note, so who knows who actually used that word.
Right.
But they came up with the message together.
Right. The cover of the book is really, really impressive and moving. First of all, I'll just describe that it's a photograph of a mine entrance lit up at night, and it sort of both invites people inside and feels almost like a warning, like warning them off. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the cover design and the photograph.
Well, on top of what you described is a mountain, and that is Mount Maurice, which is where this mine was, inside that mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the picture of the mountain, and the artist combined it with that other mine opening, which I don't know exactly what mine that is.
Okay.
But they, it's a kind of a collaboration of those two things. But I like your interpretation of it, that it's inviting and not inviting.
Yeah, I mean, there's this very first of all, there's these very tiny little white lights on the outside that, that are pretty, and then there's this very bright light that sort of invites you to come in, but then there's this dark hole, once you see past it. And I know the whole thing's very...
It sounds like a metaphor for the whole book.
Yeah.
Right. Dark hole.
So the Freemans, the family of the mine superintendent who was at least partly blamed for the accident at the time, they stayed in town. I found that very interesting. And I suppose it has to do with what you said about how this was a company town. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, and did anyone leave, or did very many people leave after?
Oh, a lot of people left because the mine closed down and it had given so many people their livelihoods.
Right, so there
so
was...
the town kind of became a ghost town after that. Lots and lots of people left Bear Creek. Now, Red Lodge, which is just 5 miles over the hill and is still thriving, had about... That didn't empty out the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But, the Freemans continued to run mines there till the middle of the 50s. And they just switched their operation to another mine they had. And, they acted like victims, too. They lost family members,
mm-hmm.
also,
mm-hmm.
Who were in the mine, a couple of brothers-in-law and things like that. So, and I just think nobody in that day and age would say, you killed our people. Some did in the inquest, but, it was more peaceful, I guess.
Yeah, okay. You include a number of wonderful photographs in the center of the book, photographs of people and of places and all these different relevant details to the book. So I'm wondering where you got the photographs. I'm assuming from family members and such. But
Yeah, most of them, either I took, if they're contemporary, or from family members, they would either give me their photos or let me take pictures of their pictures. So people were just very forthcoming with all their information. As I think I wrote in there, it's as if they were waiting 60-something years for someone to just ask, tell me what happened.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It took an outsider to ask.
Yeah. I mean, they must have just felt so pleased to be able to tell this story. And I mean, because you live with something for 60-some years without the world seeming that interested. I mean,
yeah, I think that must have been part of it. And especially that so many of them are reaching the end of their lives, they probably wanted to get it out.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoyed reading about the Bare Facts High School newspaper and the fact that this town, you know, before the accident, used to turn to this high school newspaper for its news. I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah, this little sort of mimeographed paper, which people gave me copies of them, original copies of them, and then I found other little segments in the real papers of the time. But, yeah, I love that because, you know, all the kids who worked on it almost lost fathers. So I got to see what they were like before through their writing and then what happened to them after through little reports about their prom being canceled and things like that.
Yeah. I'm sort of haunted, I suppose so were you, and this is why you wrote the book, by the idea of a town that was left, you know, so empty after the accident and populated almost entirely by widows and children. Because the other men that weren't in the mine were, I assume, off at war. So I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about their tenacity and their ability to survive this.
Well, that was the first thing that attracted me to the project. I didn't know that there was going to be all this sort of hidden corruption. I just could not conceive how these people could get up in the morning after losing everything. As I said, you know, they lost, you know, their husbands, their fathers, their sons, their neighbors, their homes, their livelihoods, everything. You know, we think we lose one terrible thing and it's the end of the world, but they lost everything. But I think they just sort of, they had to go on because of their children. They had to feed them. They didn't get any money from the mine. They got some Social Security money for themselves and their children, but not enough. And they just, I guess it was just practicality. Nobody could just hide. Which is not to say that they went on to have happy lives. A lot of them remarried a few times, not good marriages, or had other tragedies happen. But they did go on.
Yeah, I was very aware of the difference in the times to begin with. You know, I mean, apart from this mining accident, you know, various families that you wrote about had already lost children to various disease or, I suppose, maybe accidents. But, you know, these were tough times, and the war was going on. So it's really, you have to feel like these people had a strength that was built from the times as well.
Yeah, because people were losing their sons from the war, although ironically this county lost more people in the mine than they did to the whole war. But yeah, there was kind of grief all around them. They didn't want to be wimpy.
Right. Now, how many people did die in the mine?
75. Well, 74 officially, and one of the rescuers died about 6 weeks later from all the gas he inhaled.
Oh.
And 77 had gone into the shift.
Okay. So it was just the couple that were really near the entrance when it happened that got out?
Yeah, they were on a different level, and they managed to get out.
Okay. Now, you mentioned a minute ago that the families never received any sort of compensation from the government or from the mining company. Would the company have had the kind of money to be able to compensate these people, or were they bust after this?
Well, they claimed they were bust, but I found that they weren't, that they had, by the end of that year, they had a better year financially than they had the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
So they could certainly have given some money. The mine workers union gave each family $100.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an inquest, but it never led to a real, nobody filed a civil suit or anything, or a criminal that would have gotten them maybe some money.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious if you, did you go into any part of that mine while you were researching the book, or any mine?
Well, it was flooded soon after, and it's blocked off. But I did go into a mine about an hour up the road, so it's the same coal field, as they say,
mm-hmm.
Just to get a feel of what it was like. So, yeah, I did go underground about a mile in, and it was cool. I got to see what it looked like and felt like and smelled like.
And was it creepy or was it okay? Were you okay with that? Or
I was really scared, but it was much more airy than I had anticipated. It was very dark, obviously, but it was open. It was open and airy. The creepiest things were the noises. There were these, now they use plastic to cover up various areas they're not using, and when the plastic slapped against the coal, it was very loud and scary.
Mm. How many people took you in?
Oh, just one guy, the foreman of that mine, took me in, and he was, you know, this such a character, this kind of rough, skinny guy, like, oh, you know, put on your equipment and take your tag in case you die and you have to identify the remains.
Oh, my God.
Well, it was exciting. I had to keep telling myself, do not panic. Keep yourself together. So
yeah.
It went okay.
Do you have, this is kind of a personal question, but do you lean into claustrophobia at all? Do you have any problems
yes,
with that?
Yes, I do, especially on planes. But that's why, because this felt open and airy, it didn't really affect me that way.
Okay. And did you go way down? You say you went a mile in. Were you going down, or were you just straight?
In that part of the country, most of the mines are straight in, as opposed to the East Coast, where they're down.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they might slant a little bit down, but they're mostly into a mountain.
Okay. All right. You must have sort of experienced the global focus on the Chilean mine incident much more specifically than the rest of us did. You must have known exactly what was going on and really been watching that.
Oh, yeah, I really was. And one of the more poignant things is Bobby, who I read about, who was 11 at the time.
Yeah.
He's one of my best sources, and he's kind of my buddy now. After that, he said, because if you remember, there were the guys got out and they got to reunite with their children in Chile. He said those kids don't know how lucky they are that they got their fathers back. And, you know, and he was saying, you know, I wish there was that rescue equipment back when my dad was trapped.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And then there was a less positive outcome in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any sense of what sort of attitude the men had towards their work before the accident? Like, do you feel like these were people who enjoyed the work, or it was just the only way that they could survive and make a living for their families?
I don't think people really thought about, do I like this or not? It was kind of like it is today in West Virginia. There's no alternative if you want to make a decent living.
Right.
And their families did it, their fathers did it, their grandfathers did it, so they did it. And they kind of went into it with this fatalistic, well, everyone's going to die from something attitude.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the writing life. And
okay.
I'm curious what your, well, first of all, what are you working on now?
I am working on a story about a Holocaust survivor who I took care of for about 14 years and became one of my best friends. And he just died in January, so I'm sort of writing about our life together.
Mm, okay. And you took care of him in what capacity?
Well, I ended up being his healthcare proxy and his power of attorney, so I managed all his practical affairs, but I also had to get him in and out of mental hospitals and just deal with all his issues and medication, and I saw him every week. So we started off as just strangers. I wasn't in some kind of official volunteer capacity. He just ended up in my life.
Mm, okay. And then, so what's your writing schedule like? Or how do you... I mean, I'm assuming that's, again, nonfiction or maybe even memoir. So
yeah.
So is there research that you have to do, or is this a different sort of book than, obviously, Goodbye Wives and Daughters required a lot of research into the past?
Right. Well, I have been taking notes on this guy in our life for 14 years because mm-hmm. I knew that there was material here. I tend to over-research, and it's a great procrastination technique.
Yeah.
So I found all these... other survivors had left testimonies on the Steven Spielberg program that he has, where people left their oral testimonies, and I thought, oh, I have to listen to every single one of these just to see if they went through the same thing my friend went through, and then I said to myself, no, you don't. Just start writing. So I'm teaching now, so I don't have every day to write, but whenever I can, I try to sit down and do a couple of hours, go to a boring place like my local library.
What are you teaching?
I'm teaching creative nonfiction at Brown University.
Oh, right. Okay, great. Let's talk about finding a publisher. How did you find a publisher for Goodbye Wives and Daughters?
Well, I have an agent, but actually I found Nebraska and realized it would probably be a good fit and told her to contact them.
Oh, okay.
So that's how.
And how did you decide that it would be a good fit? I'm always curious when people say that. What did you base that on?
Well, I just knew that they do a lot of literary writing, not just academic writing, and a lot of Western stuff. So it just seemed like, you know, the right place. They like to do regional stuff, which I don't really consider my book regional, but they kind of did. Other larger publishers, gave the old, this, you know, we don't see the market for this, which is the standard rejection line. And, you know, I just thought cynically, well, that because they think people don't care about a bunch of poor, dead minors.
Right.
So, but university presses are much more generous that way.
Yeah. Now, did you contact a number of presses on your own outside of your work with your agent, or?
No, she did it all.
She did all the contacts. You were just sort of researching on the side and seeing what you thought.
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest hurdle is getting an agent. So I did a lot of work in pitching different agents and getting my proposal in order to send to them. And then once she took it on, it was kind of her job.
How long did it take you to find an agent, and how far were you into writing the book when you were doing that?
I was probably about a third of the way in, because you want to give them a few chapters, completed chapters, and you have to give them a whole outline of where it's going to go with nonfiction. It took me, I don't know, a couple of months, I guess, to find an agent.
Okay. And you had to write a proposal. So how did you figure out how to write a proposal, just out of curiosity?
Well, there are books that tell you how to do it.
Okay. So you just used those resources. And
yeah, and this is my second book, so I had written a proposal before. It's kind of a daunting thing because, you know, it's, you know how scary a query letter can be. It's, you know, a giant query letter that you have to take your baby and sell it to someone.
Right. And when you send a query letter to an agent, you don't send a proposal immediately, do you? Do you just send the query and then wait for them to get back to you with more interest?
Exactly, yeah. You tell them briefly what it's about and ask if they'd like to see more.
Okay. What was your favorite part of writing this book?
Oh, my favorite part of writing it or reporting it?
Well, the whole project.
Oh, I think just going to Montana and getting to know people there, you know, sitting in their kitchens and hearing these stories that they have told me over the phone or I had read about in other reports, but hearing them right from them.
Mm-hmm.
The writing was really hard. It's much easier for me to write first-person memoir-y stuff, and this was hard to make it readable because I had so much documentation and just to organize it in a way that would work. But the interviewing was really fun.
Yeah. Now, when the writing got hard, was that first draft something that wouldn't come, or are you talking about the revision was hard, or the whole thing?
The whole thing.
Yeah.
I tend to write chapters over and over again before, not write a whole thing and then rewrite it.
Okay.
So some would come easily, and then some I would just say, ugh, this one's taking me forever.
Yeah. Did you have to revisit what you were going to do structurally a lot? Did you change the way that you decided to approach it as you were working on it?
Yeah, I did. I was going to start with the kids writing their newspaper. In fact, I think I do have a few chapters about the kids just writing their newspaper, but then it didn't work. Yeah, structure was really hard to play around with. And then I just decided to pretty much go in order, starting with that trip that she took 3 weeks before it happened.
Right, right. And actually, in the introduction, you talk about your trip to Montana. And your mother had just passed away. Is that correct?
Yeah.
When you first heard about this accident, you were sort of mourning the loss of your mother.
Yeah, and she had died of pulmonary fibrosis, which there was a parallel there with people suffocating to death. And that's also why I was so attracted to the women's stories, because, you know, I was grieving and it was difficult, but it was nothing like what they had gone through. So I was just fascinated with that sort of toughness and survival mentality.
Yeah. And I wondered afterward, after I read the book, if writing it had helped you kind of heal after you losing your mother, or did that continue to feel like a relevant issue to you as you were writing the book, or did they kind of separate as you went?
Well, I think if anything, it helped me because it gave me a great distraction from that grief. Mm. It kept me really busy, and then a year and a half later, I thought, oh, remember when Mom died and I didn't know what to do with myself? And look, I've gotten this far. So I think, you know, that helped a lot. And my mother was always a really great supporter of my career, so somehow I think she might have sent me this project to keep me busy.
Was she a writer as well?
No, nobody in my family have been writers.
No.
But she was, you know, she was a fan, and she was a career counselor for people, so she was always finding me jobs or things she thought would be jobs.
Yeah.
So yeah. She's always helpful.
Talking about support systems, and I'm wondering what writers have influenced you, either personally or through their works?
Personally, well, I don't know a lot of writers who are really successful. I know more of my peers.
Mm-hmm.
But Marion Winnick is a great writer. She wrote First Comes Love, and she wrote the Glenn Ross Book of the Dead. She's a nonfiction writer based in Baltimore. And she's a friend, and she's just really, really great. I love Evie White, and I'm really into Nick Flynn these days, another Bold Knight in Suck City.
Yeah.
Such a great book. And my favorite book is The Book Thief.
Oh, The Book Thief. Was it Marcus Zusak?
Yes.
That's a wonderful book. Yeah.
It's great. I have a little passage from it above my desk because I just love the way he puts words together. Not only is that story so moving, just his language is beautiful.
Right, and it must be particularly relevant to what you're working on now.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. The Holocaust theme.
What's the passage about?
It's the one where she, he's marching, Max is marching, and she comes up to him.
Oh, right, right.
And he cries into her fingers.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a beautiful writer.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you reading now?
Well, in sort of in preparation for writing the book I'm working on now, I'm reading both Survival in Auschwitz by Primo Levi, and this great memoir called, well, it's not really a memoir. It's called Stuart, A Life Backwards, and it's about, I think it's about this homeless guy and how his life went so bad, but it's structured in a backwards way from how the author met him.
Oh, interesting.
I've just started that, but it seems great.
And do you know who wrote that?
Alexander Masters, I think.
Okay. Do you have any advice that you would offer to other writers who come across a historical event that intrigues them and they consider writing about it?
Well, don't assume that it's already been written about, because it may not have been. And people are always around who will talk about these things, even if you have to really search for them. What I did was I had a few names I had the names of the people who died, and I just Googled every single name and found any relative they had in the world and just started calling relatives, and everyone would give me more names. So, you know, don't be daunted by thinking, oh, who am I going to find to talk about this?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel like, oh my God, you know, what have I taken on, and do I really want to spend 2 years on this?
A little bit, but I also had that feeling like I'm going to write this book even if nobody publishes it.
Because it needs to be written, or?
Yeah, like I just thought I'll self-publish if I have to, and that was, you know, before it was kind of acceptable to self-publish. I just felt like it's a story I needed to tell, you know, I felt so passionate about it that I had to get it out there, and it just seemed wrong that people didn't know that this terrible thing happened. I wanted to write it as to honor the people who went through it.
Yeah. All right, great. Well, Susan, thank you so much for talking with me. This was really interesting.
Oh, I'm so glad we finally got it together.
Yeah. Take care. Bye.
All right, thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Susan Kushner-Resnick. That last comment was an allusion to the fact that we had rescheduled this a few times, so that's kind of funny. You can learn more about Susan's work and about Bear Creek, Montana, and the coal mining disaster of 1943 at the website coalminedisaster.com, which is Susan Kushner-Resnick's website. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Susan Kushner-Resnick, who does teach, as she mentioned, and occasionally she assigns this exercise to her students. Describe a loved one's body part. For example, describe your brother's eyebrow or your best friend's teeth. This writing exercise allows you to get very specific and paint a picture in detail about someone you know well. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with your friends from out of town, let them know they can stream it live every Monday from 2 to 3 at theradiator.org. And Write the Book is archived as a podcast on iTunes and also at writethebook.podbean.com. And those are free podcasts. If you have comments about Write the Book or news about book-related events that you'd like me to announce, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And that is also the email address where you can send writing prompts. And if I use a writing prompt that you've sent during the show, I will happily credit you. Cheryl Willoughby will be here at 3 o'clock with the World of Music. This has been Write the Book, and I am Shayla Shapiro. You're listening to Community Radio, The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Thank you.